Thank you very much, Mr. Jennings, and a happy Friday evening to everyone out there listening to WGN Radio, either on 720 AM or, of course, online at WGNRadio.com, wherever you're listening. Thank you so much for joining. John Hanson until 1 o'clock in the morning, tomorrow morning, of course. This is October 11th. It is 10:06 p.m., and we are 18 stories above the Chicago River and Wacker Drive. We've got a packed show for you today. A little bit later on, we're going to be chatting. We're going to do What's Up with Space with Mike Wall from space.com. Blake Stubbs going to be joining us as well to chat about some cool things happening at the movies. And we're going to have some really cool local stuff as well. But let's talk to Mr. Mike Heideman. Mike Heideman, how you doing, buddy?
John, it's great to see you. I'm doing fantastic.
Well rested because you filled in for DiGilio this morning.
Yes, I did. And I fell asleep right after and haven't woken up since.
You're still you slept walk on over here.
Yep. But it was a great show. Thanks again to Nick and Mary and everybody and Pete and Tom for a great show last night. It was an honor to fill in for Nick.
Big apologies to everyone on Michigan Avenue that saw Mike sleepwalking down to the studio. He doesn't know what he does when he's in those moments. He just kind of guides his way over here somehow.
It wasn't a zombie. It was Michael Heideman. Yes.
Yeah.
Just making sure she knew.
312-91-7200. We'd love for you to join the conversation and get involved. You can text, you can call on in, and your participation. I'm going to say it's voluntary tonight, or not, it's involuntary tonight. Well, it's always voluntary normally, but we need your help a little bit later on because we're going to be doing something fun. We'll play a little Today I Learned, of course, as well, and some other things. But Mike, can we get some dramatic music to tee up what we're going to be doing here after the first commercial break? There we go. And this is really going to set it up. It is spooky season, after all. And, of course, here in Chicago, we are, I don't want to say blessed, we have one of the spookiest, scariest stories built into our city's history. It's a mystery that has reigned now for 148 years, and here is how it starts. Late one night, when we were all in bed, Mrs. O'Leary lit a lantern in the shed. Her cow kicked it over, then winked her eye and said, "There'll be a hot time in the old town tonight." The Chicago Fire, residents waking up in Chicago 148 years ago today, with tons of buildings, people dead after 2 days of fire rained through the city. We're going to walk through the history. Look, I think everyone knows a little bit about the Chicago Fire. I think we all have our theories of the things that we know. Michael, I mean, we all know the basics. 1871, fire spread.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of buildings burned.
The folklore, the cow kicked over the can.
Yes.
You know, and it spread, and then we needed to rebuild the city, the whole thing.
Not a can of lantern, Mike.
Oh.
Just kicked over a can of beans. That didn't start no fire, Mike.
I heard it was a can.
No, it was a lantern. Right. No, that wouldn't have started any fire. Yeah, there is so many different theories out there, and I have narrowed it down to four culprits. So what we're going to be doing just after the break is I'm going to tell you the true story of the Chicago Fire, then all the permutations of the conjecture. I mean, it was 1871, so a lot of people have a lot of different theories. And then I need you, listeners, to be the jury. 312-981-7200. Get ready to call in towards the end of the story and vote for who we finally agree upon, maybe, who is the culprit behind the start of the Chicago Fire. I've got it narrowed down to four candidates. Of course, Mrs. O'Leary's cow is one of them. There's someone named Peg Leg Sullivan. Who was a likely culprit. In fact, one of our esteemed aldermen said, in quotes, Edward Burke, about 21 years ago, tried to actually get the city to kind of indict him postmortemly, of course, as being okay. The one, as being Peg-Leg Sullivan. There's a theory of comets and meteors being what caused the Chicago Fire. There's some really interesting facts about other fires that were lit on the very same night. In fact, far more deadly fires in Wisconsin on the very same night, and in Michigan, too. And then there's the story of Lewis Cohn, who is a gambler, and he is the only person to have ever at least partially admitted to being in the barn when the fire started, and I had never heard of this gentleman. So we're going to be breaking it down and determining who really set who or what really set the Chicago fire and chat about those stories as well. John Hanson until 1 a.m. Quick commercial break, and then we're going to talk about the Chicago fire here on 720 WGN. 720 WGN, John Hanson in until 1 in the morning. Thanks so much for joining us, and we say a pleasant good evening. He's bopping over in the news studio, which has been newly disinfected. I saw him spreading the wipes all over. Mr. Roger Badish, I hope you're feeling better, my friend.
Well, I'm here with you. It's a Friday night in Chicago, and I'm feeling fine.
You ready to be the judge and jury here tonight, Mr. Badish?
Guilty!
No.
Oh, wait, what?
Okay, Roger's all fired up, ready to go. No pun intended.
Right.
Michael, are you ready to go?
Always ready to go.
In case you just are joining us, we are going to break down the Chicago fire, which had just been put out 148 years ago today, and people were waking up in Chicago. Many lost loved ones. Much of the city burned, wondering where they'd go next and wondering how it started. So, why don't we start from the beginning? I just want to let everyone know I got some great information from the Great Chicago Fire of 1871, a book by Paul Benny. Wikipedia, big helper too. The History Channel, Time Magazine, Chicago Magazine, and Chicago Tribune as well. So, 1871, Chicago, the fastest growing city in America. But haphazardly, wooden construction had imperiled it to be an invisible enemy. In fact, a single spark from a tossed down cigar or an unattended candle could ignite fire that would rage unchecked. Chicagoans weren't blind to the threat. Only 1 month before the Chicago fire, the Tribune, which of course is the big newspaper here, had warned Chicagoans that buildings downtown were mere fire traps, pleasing to the eye, and nothing more than shams and shingles. So a month beforehand, Chicago Tribune was already hypothesizing that something bad could happen. So let's go to October 1871, a dry month in the city. The last decent rains had fallen over 3 months prior. Can you imagine? We've had so much rain over the last couple weeks. It seems like every Friday night we're talking about storms in the area. 3 months since the last fires had fallen. So you've got a real dry tinderbox forming. Not only in Chicago, but of course the entire Great Lakes region had been very dry. The wells were dry. The grass was brown, and the tar roofs simmered and bubbled in the sun. Each day, dry winds from the overheated prairies blew into the city and parched all the buildings. It was a dangerous condition for a town built completely, mostly by white pine. From the wooden fences that marked the boundary of every single property to the sheds filled with hay, pine shavings, everything in Chicago had grown brittle as kindling under the sweltering sun. So anything could start a fire, right? Boys playing with matches set houses on fire. It happened all the time. A spark flying from the torch of a roof repairman, that would set a church building on fire. All these things happened in the weeks leading up to the fire. The fire department was incredibly busy. And then on October 7th, so 1 day before the start of one of the most infamous fires in American history, there was a blaze at the Lull and Holmes planing mill that has sapped the final strength of the firefighters. So they've been working throughout the months, and we get this big fire at the Lull and Holmes planing mill. It was a woodworking factory on the west side of Chicago, nestled in among frame houses, a paper box company, coal yards. 7 million feet of wood were stacked in lumber yards in the surrounding neighborhood. It was around 11 o'clock at night, and the mill caught fire. No one ever sure why. Flames quickly jumping to other buildings. It was a strong wind. The fire, it spread it north, changed directions, drove it southwest. The piles of lumber caught fire and helped scattered flames like quicksilver. And in 20 minutes, 4 city blocks were ablaze. This isn't the big fire. This is the day before the big fire. 3 alarms sounded. And look, fires in Chicago at the time, honestly, they were cheap entertainment. This, according to the book, The Great Chicago Fire of 1871. When the skies lit up with the rose glows of flames, people poured from their houses like a bell had rung at a free boxing match. So the Lowell and Holmes fire was the biggest one yet. Thousands took to the street to watch it, In fact, they blocked Adam Street. They prevented the blaze from spreading north. They didn't have the manpower to protect the river with its wooden bridges, wooden ships, and wooden train cars lined up. Spectators sprung into action. They saved a railroad freight and passenger buildings. They tore down sheds that lay between the fire and the bigger buildings so that the flames would run out of fuel. These amateur firefighters managed to roll the train cars safely out of the way. The fire department putting up a heroic fight. They had drawn a line at Adam Street. They would said that that fire is not crossing over this. They hooked up 12 hoses, completely flooded the burning area. So they were able to contain this fire. But the citizens were there, of course, watching. In fact, the fire marshal and chief were yelling at police to arrest people because they were blocking, they were gawking, and they were preventing it. So that morning, even before the fire was completely out, the Tribune ran its Sunday paper with special coverage of the event, which they dubbed the Great Chicago Fire. The first paragraph was eerily prophetic from the Chicago Tribune the morning of what ended up being the big fire. For days past, alarm has followed alarm, but the comparatively trifling losses have familiarized us to the pealing of the courthouse bell, and we had forgotten that the absence of rain for 3 weeks had left everything in such a dry and inflammable condition that a spark might set a fire which would sweep from end to end of the city. That's the morning of the fire, the Tribune post that. So people are very aware of what's happened. I mean, Roger, this walking through this history is just fascinating. The first-hand accounts of what really set up this situation.
Nobody knows. I mean, really, this is not taught in any of the schools.
Oh, no. They
just the Chicago fire. The city almost burned down. Blah, blah, blah. Mrs. O'Leary Carl.
Right.
That's it.
Right.
We don't know the history before it, let alone the night before.
Right.
This is very interesting, and it may change my judgment.
Oh, that's right. Because at the end of this, we're going to try and figure out what actually happened. I'm just trying to give you all the context.
Yeah.
I'm setting it up like opening statements.
I'm the
prosecutor marching around the courthouse ready to, or the defense attorney.
Pound your fist on the bar?
Bailiff. Let's get a bailiff in here. Heidemann's the bailiff tonight.
Okay.
He's that sassy bailiff that participates.
Sassy?
Yeah, well, he's always a little sassy. All right. Mike, you're our sassy bailiff. How are you feeling so far, Mike?
I feel great. You know, that's why I wore my tuxedo to court. sassy too.
You know, I once wrote a blackout scene for something like that.
Right.
Yeah, a guy walking across the stage holding a suit on a hanger. And he's taking, another guy walks by and says, "Where are you going?" I said, "I'm taking my suit to court." Half an hour later, a guy walks with a ladder and the suit on a hanger. And a guy walks by and says, "Where are you going now?" He says, "I'm taking my suit to a higher court."
Oh, boy. By the way, 708 has already texted. I don't think we have to do the rest of the story. They say he solved it. It's Bartman. He started the Chicago fire. All right. So we've set up the scene now.
Yeah.
So there's a fire the night before that the Tribune calls the Great Chicago Fire, not knowing what's in store on October 8th, 1871. So the Sunday afternoon following the Lull and Holmes fire that we were talking about, the fire chief, Williams, he went home, he tried to sleep, but in his usual dedicated way, he woke up several times and attended to the business of the fire department. On October 8th, he had to put out a small fire on the south side of the city. He climbed on the wagon and he headed home again. The winds began to rise. He tugged his helmet down to keep it from blowing away. Then, as reports have it, he turned to his driver and said, "We are going to have a burn. I can feel it in my bones." "I'm going to bed early," he said. "I feel as though I've got to get out and be out between this morning and this wind is blowing." And boy, was it. And now we go to the cow barn. Around 9 p.m. on October 8th, 1871, the fire chief fast asleep in Chicago. Daniel Pegleg Sullivan, who is suspect number one. Pegleg Sullivan sat down on a wooden sidewalk, pausing a few moments to enjoy the strangely hot October night and its humming wind. He was a 26-year-old drayman, which I don't know what that is, or a cart driver. Oh, good. Just read the next few words, John. That'll help.
That'll help, yeah.
Who had lost his leg in a railroad accident. As he sat down on the wooden boards, he adjusted his peg leg to make himself comfortable, leaned back against a fence that ran behind the sidewalk. Before him, the West Side neighborhood of poor Irish immigrants was going to sleep, the lamps blinking out one by one. He yawned. He, too, would have to go to bed in a few minutes so he could get up early, hitch up his horses, and drive his cart for the oil company. So this is on DeKoven Street, which is a name that is not familiar to us. If you know the story, it is. It's basically an alley. And when they said this was on the southwest side of the city, that was in 1871. Now where right. we know it is not that far away. Think of White Palace Grill at Canal and Roosevelt and go a block north and a block west. You're right there. We could probably see it if there were no buildings between
here
and there.
Well, you know what's there now, if I'm not mistaken.
The Chicago Fire Academy.
You got that right.
Is on the site.
Mm-hmm.
So anyways, across the street from Daniel, Pegleg Sullivan, were two houses, one facing the street and another tucked behind it. The one facing the street was the McLaughlin's house, and fiddle music was floating from the windows. Hey, Mike, nice job. You got this fiddle music queued up pretty good.
Oh, I know the story like the back of my hand.
So the McLaughlin's, they were having a little party, a Sunday night celebration to celebrate the arrival of a relative from Ireland. The house behind that house was the O'Leary house, where Catherine and Patrick O'Leary lived with their five children. All the lights were already out in the O'Leary house, and just behind that was the O'Leary's barn, where Catherine O'Leary kept her five milk cows and her horse and calf. And that's suspect number two. So Daniel knew that barn very well, Pegleg. His mother kept a cow in there, and some nights Daniel would actually just stop in and feed it hay. Now, as Daniel slumped against the fence, feeling increasingly sleepy, he thought he saw something strange. It looked like a yellow tongue of light kind of waving from side to side at the O'Leary barn. And as he watched it, his body began to grow stiff with worry. He straightened up off the fence, straining for a better look. It's 9 at night. It's dark. The yellow light flickered and wagged in the darkness. And then he knew it. It was a flame, no doubt about it. His heart started to pound as he scrambled from the wooden sidewalk into the street. He struggled to make it. His wooden leg couldn't help him move any faster. Fire! 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 He shouted into the wind. He got across the darkened lawn to the O'Leary property, making his way straight for the barn. As he stepped inside, he felt this blast of heat. He saw a tempest of flames whipping back and forth in the hayloft. It's hay. It's dry. The barn, everything is dry, and everything's going up pretty fast. It was too late to save that barn, but Daniel thought he might be able to save some of the animals. Four cows to his left, he managed to untie two of them before the heat became too intense. He yelled at the cows, but they stood frozen, refusing to flee. The flames were too strong now. The die had been cast, and the Great Chicago Fire had started. We've met two of our suspects. We'll hear more about the fire and meet our other two suspects in a bit. On WGN. 720 WGN. John Hansen here till 1 in the morning. And we're trying to decide who really started the Chicago fire. And we need your help through and to 91-7200. All right. So we're telling the story first with big help. And thank you to the Great Chicago Fire of 1871, the book written by Paul Benny. All right, so we're going to set our scene again for those of you just joining us. Paul Pegleg Sullivan is the name of a gentleman who was nearby after celebrating a party, or he knew there was a party nearby. He was laying against his fence. He spotted a fire in the O'Leary's barn just a few houses away. He ran into the barn. He knew it well, and he was helping some of the cows get out of the fire, and that's where we left off, because Daniel's story, Pegleg Sullivan, is a fascinating one at that. So Daniel's in the fire. It's hot in this barn, and he's trying to save these terrified animals. Four cows to his left. He unties two of them, and that heat becomes intense. So he yells at the cows. We talked about this. But Daniel felt like he was going to die with these petrified animals. He ran for the alleyway door, but his peg leg, he had it injured in an accident earlier, his peg leg slipped and sent him sprawling. He coughed in the thick black smoke and tried to stand. Before he could get his balance, a calf came running from behind and banged his hip. The animal's back was on fire, and it was howling in pain and fear. Daniel grabbed the rope around its neck and pulled it with him. Remember, there's flames everywhere at this point. So Daniel grabbed the rope, pulled it with him towards the barn door. Together, they burst into the alley, where Daniel slapped the flames off the calf's back. So this commotion now is raising, the fire is growing, and at last the neighbors begin to emerge from their houses, and one of them, a man named Dennis Regan, ran out of the O'Leary's house and woke the family. Mr. O'Leary came out of the yard, scratched his head in disbelief. "Kate," he yelled, "the barn is afire!" Mrs. O'Leary and her five children ran from the house. The neighbors helped Mr. O'Leary throw buckets of water onto his house, which had already begun to smolder. Mrs. O'Leary, faced with the loss of her barn, her livestock, tried at least to save a new wagon that was parked behind the barn, but the searing heat would not let her near enough. Soon the sparks flew, started the wagon, a shed, another barn on fire. Then the flames sped across a wooden fence to the Dalton's house, the first actual house to catch fire, and the Great Chicago Fire had begun. We've met two of our suspects of who started this, actually. Daniel Pegleg Sullivan, more on him in a bit. And, of course, one of the cows, the old adage that the lantern was kicked over. That sort of conspiracy, I guess, spread through folklore, through tellings and local news. But let's talk about the spread of the fire. So firefighters finally arrive at DeCoven Street again. They're exhausted. They've been fighting fires, including a giant one the night before. The fire chief was trying to get some much-needed sleep. It's dry, and this fire spreads quickly to neighboring buildings. It was progressing towards the Central Business District. Keep in mind, it's about a mile southwest of downtown, Roosevelt Canal-ish, if you can kind of picture that, kind of where the West Loop is, White Palace Grill, and the site of the current Chicago Fire Academy. So this fire is spreading to the business district. Firefighters had hoped that the south branch of the river and an area that had previously been burned would actually act as a natural fire break. But along the river were lumber yards, warehouses, coal yards, barges, and the bridges across the river were not steel as we know them now. They were wooden, of course. So the fire grew, and that southwest wind intensified, became superheated. It caused structures to catch fire from the heat and from the burning debris, of course, from the wind. So the fire started around 9. By midnight, flaming debris blew across the river and landed on the roofs of the Southside Gas Works. With the fire moving across the river, moving rapidly towards the heart of the city, this is when panic sets in. The mayor at the time was a man named Roswell B. Mason. He sent messages to nearby towns asking for help. Imagine if you telegraphed, that would be my guess, Roger. I think it's probably the only way to communicate quickly in 1871.
Yeah, they didn't have shortwave radio or anything like that. No, no.
Right, or maybe messenger by horses. I don't know. Whatever you can do.
Or grab a kid on the corner and tell him to go run over.
Yeah.
You know.
When the courthouse caught fire, he ordered the building to be evacuated and the prisoners jailed in the basement to be released. 2.5 hours later, 2:30 in the morning, now we're on October 9th. The courthouse collapsed, sending the great bell crashing down. Some witnesses reported hearing the sound from a mile away. As more buildings succumbed to the flames, a major contributing factor to the fire spread was a meteorological phenomenon known as a fire whirl. As overheated air rises, it comes in contact with the cooler air, begins to spin. It's kind of like a fire tornado, for lack of a better description.
Oh, I hate those. Yeah. Really bad.
They happen in California a lot.
Oh, my.
Well, these fire whirls are what likely drove flaming debris so high and so far. So areas far away from the source of the fire where it had spread are catching fire. Because remember, it's so dry that you get some flying debris that's on fire. It lands on a nearby building or a couple blocks down.
Within split seconds.
Yep. Such debris was blown across the main branch of the Chicago River. So now we're crossing the south branch. Obviously, it splits. Now we're crossing it again to the north side.
Okay.
It blows across the main branch to a railroad car carrying kerosene. The fire had jumped the river a second time. It was raging across the city's north side now, up Michigan Avenue. Also a likely factor in the fire spread was the amount of flammable waste that had accumulated in the river from years of improper disposal methods used by local industries. I still think they're clearing that out, by the way.
I'm not swimming in that river.
Yeah,
yeah, it's further down. Yeah. It looks nice on the surface.
You're kayaking, you're fine, but I wouldn't go much deeper.
Yeah, exactly. No.
So, despite the fact that the fire is spreading, it's growing rapidly, the city's firefighters, weary from days and days of fighting fires, are trying their best to battle this blaze. A short time after the fire jumped the river, a burning piece of timber lodged on the roof of the city's waterworks.
Uh-oh.
Within minutes, the interior of the building was engulfed in flames, and the building was destroyed. And with it, the city's main mains and the water mains, they went dry.
Uh-oh.
And at that point...
Well, there you go. That's...
The city's helpless at that point.
Yeah.
The fire burned unchecked, building to building, block to block. All day on October 9th, this fire rages. But late in the evening on October 9th, it started to rain. but the fire had already started to burn itself out. It had spread to sparsely populated areas of the north side, having consumed the densely populated areas thoroughly.
Mm-hmm.
So, once the fire had ended, the smoldering remains were still too hot to survey the damage. For many days, eventually the city determined the fire destroyed about 4 miles long and about 3/4 mile wide. So kind of a narrow, long pathway encompassing an area more than 2,000 acres. Destroyed were more than 73 miles of roads, 120 miles of sidewalk, 2,000 lampposts, 17,500 buildings, and $222 million in property, which is about a third of the city's entire valuation in 1871.
Yeah.
90,000 Chicago residents, 1 in 3 Chicagoans left homeless, 120 bodies recovered, but the death toll likely was near 300. The coroner speculated that an accurate count was impossible. Some victims may have drowned or been incinerated, of course, leaving no remains. So that's the fire. And now we got to figure out who did it. So the legend of Mrs. O'Leary's cow kind of gets popularly told by a writer who later admits that he made it up for a good copy. And as we kind of mentioned, that most witnesses seem to describe the O'Leary's emerging from their house sleeping. Doesn't mean that the cow didn't do it itself, though. Maybe the O'Leary's left a lantern on. Pegleg claims that the barn and all the buildings were dark, but maybe one small lantern in the hay, perhaps the cow did kick it over. I don't think the popular theory is that Mrs. O'Leary was milking the cow.
Right.
The cow kicked it over. That doesn't seem likely, but the cow is still a suspect, one of those 5 cows that was in the barn.
Mm-hmm.
So I mentioned Daniel Pegleg, and here's how he becomes a suspect. Pegleg Sullivan, who in his retelling of the story,
right,
finds the fire first, yells out, in fact, gets trapped in it and is rescued by the rope of a calf running out. Which, if it sounds a little too good to be true, maybe it is. A century after the fire, officials turned their attention to this suspect. Time magazine reporting in 1971 that Mrs. O'Leary's one-legged neighbor, who was allegedly, according to other people, having a nightcap in the barn.
Mm-hmm.
He said he was laying down by the fence, a couple away, about to retire for the evening. Others say no, he was having a nightcap in that barn. He admitted he knew the barn. He admitted to people that he had been in that barn time before. So maybe he was trying to stay off the public way, having a nightcap, when a spark from his pipe ignited the hay. As he tried to flee, his peg leg stuck in the floor.
To blame people, you're not going to blame somebody who's going to be able to be traced uphill. Now, if you blame Mrs. O'Leary's cow, the cow can't be sued.
Yeah.
It can be the O'Leary.
Can't litigate against a cow. Boy, I've tried.
You can't litigate against a cow. So Dick Bales is the author, and boy, if I had the book at my hand, I would be able to page through in books.
I'll look it up. Hey, Paul.
Hundreds of pages of books.
Paul's going with Lewis Cohn. Thank you for the phone call, Paul. All right, we got a Cohn. We got a Pegleg Sullivan. Michael Heidemann, who are you doing? Who done it?
This is very interesting because I didn't realize how many different angles you could take with this story.
Mm-hmm.
I think that... because Roger brought up a lot of good points, and then Paul just came out with me with a solid curveball.
Right. My whole jury is tainted, by the way. You all have, other research y'all have done. Just supposed to listen to the evidence in front of you and make a decision.
The beautiful thing is that back in the day when they really needed to pin this down, that's why they probably all blamed the cow, because they're like, I don't need a record. I have nothing. We don't have Google yet.
They're like, whatever. Who cares? Let's move on with our lives.
What I'm thinking, though, is after hearing your story, which was great, and it was cool how it was laid out in all those fashions. I don't think it was the comet.
Okay, no comet, all right.
A little bit too out there, and I think that comets do get a little bit colder when they hit Earth. We could ask.
Oh, yeah, we could ask, what's up with space coming up at midnight?
But, Pegleg Sue, he was...
Pegleg Sullivan.
Oh.
Okay.
We go way back. I know it was something different.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That was a good way to look at it because, he...
I'm so glad they don't do trials like this where they ask each jury member to decide individually
and
tell us how...
Well, we're polling the jury.
How they got to this. They just say a name. Jeez, what the heck is happening? Thank God. Trials last long enough already without asking the jury to give a darn 2 paragraphs on what they think.
Yeah, I like the lunch in the jury room.
Leave it for the deliberation room. Let's go. Come on. Beep, beep.
Okay, my God. So after gathering the evidence, I think that what I would have to go with is, like most fires, it's usually set by a group of rowdy kids, and for that reason, I'm going with Mr. Lewis Cone.
Mr. Lewis Cone. That's two for Cone, one for Peg Leg. And I am going to sway us all the way over. I know you need a unanimous jury here in the United States, but I think Lewis Cone did it. He admitted to it. Gambling makes sense. And then also Peg Leg, it kind of can match up with some of the stories. Mm-hmm. Peg Leg Sullivan isn't necessarily lying when that fire breaks out. He sees it and runs into the barn. I don't know if, you know, some of the details have changed over the years. I think he embellished it a little bit that he got stuck in the cow dragged him out, that sort of stuff. I don't necessarily believe, but that makes sense because they said the gambling, once the fire started, they had drawn attention to the game. They didn't think it was going to spread that far. He grabs the money, they all spread quickly, and then in comes and Peg Leg here, and I don't think it's a comet. I think that's a great theory, and I really believed that for a while until I read more of the science behind it, and I'd say let's stop blaming the cows. One more theory on 312-917-200 from the texter. Jerry says he suspects it was Brian Noonan, and guess what? It was Sunday night just after 9 o'clock, so Noonan wrapping up his show might have gone just a few miles away for a little craps game. I know Noonan likes underground craps games, and I'm sure that happened. And Fijian Radio was almost around at the time. That was fun.
Just about, yeah.
So the case is closed. Ding dong. Do we have a gavel noise? Do we have anything? There it is. We have ruled Lewis Cone set the fire. We'll change subjects after this, thank God, on 720 WGN.
Now from your theater screens to the radio waves, Blockbuster Blake Stubbs.
All righty, we are moving off the Chicago fire. Blockbuster Blake Stubbs, buddy, how you doing?
Hey, my man, I'm doing all right. About yourself?
Doing very, very well. I had to get to chat with you. First and foremost, obviously, we'll get to the Joker stuff in a little bit. Do you mind if we start with that? Because we got just a few minutes here before we got to do the news. We're going to do El Camino after the news. I'll give you a little bit more time. Because the Joker, obviously, has been out for a little while. Everyone's kind of had their take on it, but I haven't had a chance to ask you on the radio about it. I know a lot of listeners at this time are used to hearing kind of your takes on it, maybe curious if they haven't seen the movie yet and what they should do. So I imagine, obviously, as always, go out and see it yourself for your own opinion. But your thoughts on the Joker?
Honestly, there's one positive out of this film that is inarguable, and that is Joaquin Phoenix's performance is one that I think all cinema lovers should go out and check out. It is incredibly layered. It is dark. It is twisted. It takes you on a ride. One minute you feel bad for him. The next, you don't know what to think. And all of that relies on an excellent performance. I think the film itself is incredibly flawed. I think it's also very derivative. I think a lot of audiences have seen this before, especially if you've seen Scorsese's Taxi Driver or King of Comedy. I'm kind of saying with the, preaching to the choir for people who like to debate whether this movie is good or bad in that regard. But honestly, I kind of put a little checklist together. I didn't feel like there's twists and turns in this movie. I didn't feel like those were really the reasons I stayed in my seat. I felt like the performance was so good that I couldn't walk away. You know how, and John, you can comment on this. You know how, like, if you buy a ticket to go to the theater, live theater, right? You know, that's like an investment. It's not like you just paid $8 and you can just walk out if you're just not enjoying it. You feel like you got to stay. That's kind of how I felt while I was watching this, except it was like I was watching bad theater, except there was one performance that just had me so glued that there was nothing that was going to get me to walk out of there. Mm-hmm. And that was Phoenix. He was the draw. I think that this movie didn't really stick with me. I'm not really thinking about it too much afterwards. I think it feels trying to come off like it's a bit smarter than it actually is. But again, that's isolating and taking away like the greatness of this one performance that I think is really drawing people in. It's scary, man.
What do you think about the?
So good. He's at his best.
There's so much controversy around it, which I've never understood about people.
Right.
The violence, the background. I mean, you know, I didn't see the movie, so you'll have to let me know. But like, aren't we supposed to explore the deep, dark places that the human mind and actions can go in cinema?
That is a great venue for it, I think, especially if. We're in a society now, and it's funny that I say we're in a society, or we live in a society. That's like a big meme that has followed this film. But one thing is that I feel that if performance is so good and the character is well crafted, and that part of that is in the writer's room, Okay, that isn't just the actor. It's also like what they've given the actor to create with. You can explore and see and learn to feel differently about things through cinema that maybe you don't give enough credence to on a daily basis. You know, I mean, Roger Ebert talked a lot about how empathy is such a huge part of the human condition and why we're here and what makes us better. When you go and watch movies, hopefully they're good enough that you start to connect and feel, and then you can render judgments or you can have some kind of reaction. When I was watching Joker, I felt like I'd seen so much of it before, except for that performance. So I had so many thoughts about the character of Arthur Fleck, which is who Phoenix is playing, or at one point he asks Robert De Niro's character to call him Joker. And so that's where the title of the movie comes from. Of course, it's tied into the Gotham City, DC Batman world. But it's not too overt. And that's where I'm kind of like, why was this even a Joker film? Why couldn't this have just been a great character study? And tried not to borrow so much from things that have already existed. And maybe the film would have stood better on its own outside of, again, a great performance. I mean, this will be a very much talked about performance as we go into awards season.
Blake,
and I think it's worth paying to see.
Yeah.
So for that reason.
I don't want to put you on the spot, Blake, but I just saw it come across the wire. Did you hear about Robert Forster died?
I did, and I was going to bring that up in the discussion about El Camino because he's in it.
That's crazy.
And actually gives a stellar, he is a perfect performer in El Camino. And maybe that's a bit of a tease for what we're going to discuss further. But Robert Forster, who many will, the guy has over 186 acting credits. He was an actor's actor. He made a big splash and won an Academy Award for his work in Jackie Brown, Quentin Tarantino's Jackie Brown. One of the movies that I think you could watch, it's fairly recent, but it was The Descendants with George Clooney. He's in that movie and he's outstanding in that as well. So, I mean, he's just one of those actors who has a lot of gravitas in everything he does. And all of his interactions in El Camino, some of them are funny, but not like in that ha-ha way. They're just, if you want to know what can make a great actor from a good actor, from a bad actor, watch their eyes. If the camera ever gets close and you get a chance to look in their eyes and see, you know that there's so much going on. I think Forster had some of the best eyes in the business.
Yeah.
The guy's a legend. Bad to hear that he passed.
Yeah, on the day the movie was released. More with Blockbuster Blake and El Camino and Robert Forster and all that coming up after this break in the news on 720 WGN. Thank you very much, Mr. Banish. Props to Roger, by the way, who is fighting through everything. Getting through that illness there, Roger. Thanks for coming in tonight. We appreciate it. Powering through that last newscast there. 720 WGN, this is Breaking Bad. Many folks know that theme pretty well. One of those folks is Blockbuster Blake Stubbs. And El Camino, the movie based on the series, I guess based on or part of a continuation. Actually, I'll just let Blake explain it. Dropped on Netflix today. So what is it?
So El Camino is a sort of continuation. It's sort of a revisit. At the end of the series, and without spoiling too much, it's left very open-ended about what happens to the fate or in the fate of the life of Jesse Pinkman, played by Aaron Paul,
okay,
who is a massive favorite. And if you know just a little bit of trivia about the series, the plan was to kill his character off very early. In fact, I believe it was by the end of the first season, but he was so like resoundingly loved by audiences, he stayed through till the very end. And it's left very open-ended about what happened to him. He gets away from his captors, but then it's him crying, driving El Camino away from it, and from being captured, and you're wondering what happened to him. This film seeks to answer that question. Now, I don't want to spoil too much. I think Breaking Bad fans who, you know, have had to work their day jobs and are, you know, got a lot going on, they definitely want to sit down and watch this movie. But the question is it good? Because, you know, when you pick up something years removed from it and you want to retell that story, Deadwood did this recently, and I think fans of Deadwood were very happy with the end result. Fans of Breaking Bad, I also would argue, will be very happy with what happens here. Aaron Paul is back to play Jesse Pinkman, and you will see a host of characters that you know, love, or maybe hate from Breaking Bad reappear. Even if it's just in brief moments, this film uses nonlinear storytelling to sort of keep you in the present, but also show you what was going on with Jesse at certain points in time. And the thing that I loved about the movie, honestly, is that it showed how someone who has gone through extreme trauma. Now, this is a guy that was beaten, tortured, held captive in like a concrete hole, and forced to cook methamphetamine because he's one of two people who knows how to cook the most pristine version of it, mm-hmm. Against his will. And I think that him reliving things when certain things trigger him and the way the show or the movie puts all that together, it's a very compelling 2 hours of movie to sit and watch. Mm-hmm. And this is released on Netflix. If you have Netflix, anybody can watch it. This is Aaron Paul, I think, at his absolute best. And I think a lot of people missed him playing Jesse Pinkman. So if you want one last ride, here you go. There will be some surprises, some people showing up that you might not have thought you'd get to see, but you liked when you watch Breaking Bad. And honestly, Robert Forster, it's tragic that he passed away today. The guy's 78 years old. He was a complete legend in the entertainment industry. But this is one of his final performances. And there's a couple sequences that are just downright hilarious with him, strictly because of how straight he plays them. And it takes like a really good actor to do what he does in the sequences, and just he hits a home run in every little bit that he is on camera in this. And he was a character that came in at the end of Breaking Bad, so he has a very specific purpose, and he gets to be put to good use, I think, in this movie. So I think fans are going to enjoy this. I certainly did.
Here's a stupid question. I think I know the answer to it. So I watched maybe a year and a half of Breaking Bad. I'm one of the very few humans who just mm-hmm. didn't get into it. But having said that, I sure. would not be against giving it a second chance. So, but what I'm wondering is, I should watch the series before I watch the film, yeah?
I would recommend yes, because I think that for you to get the absolute highest amount of enjoyment out of what El Camino is trying to do, for you to have, you got to have like all that deep connection with all the characters and the inner workings and everything that went on, because it will revisit a lot of things from the show that maybe you had questions about, or maybe you didn't know, or there's sequences where, you know, Aaron Paul right now is, I think, 8 years removed almost from Breaking Bad, but he goes back and plays, and this is newly shot stuff, where they're doing sequences that took place in the timeline of when the show was going on. So it adds way more emotional depth, I think, to the characters that if you've seen the show, you get a lot out of. Now, on the flip side, if you're like, Blake, I don't have time, I'm not going to do that. This film is brilliantly acted. It's very well put together, and I think it's one of the better things that Netflix has produced, and I'm glad they did it. Now, the line that I kind of came up with, like, what's the end goal here? It's, you know, did we really need this movie? Probably not. In fact, a lot of reviews are saying that, like, this is kind of unnecessary. But I think this is definitely one of the rare cases where it's something fans absolutely wanted, and I think it delivers in the end.
Yeah.
I'm pro this. I want fans to dive into this and enjoy it.
So
and also, Robert Forster didn't actually win an Academy Award. I double-checked on that. He lost to Robin Williams for Good Will Hunting, but he was nominated for Jackie Brown.
Oh, Good Will Hunting. There we go. Yeah. Not your fault. Yeah. So El Camino is on Netflix, but I just kind of Googled it, so I know a little bit what the heck I'm talking about. Something I do, a little trick, the trade. and I noticed showtimes for it. So are they doing, like, limited release? Because it's playing at the Music Box on the north side, and then it's playing out in Bolingbrook and South Barrington. So if you don't have Netflix or you love the experience of seeing it on the big screen, you do have some options here in the Chicago area.
100%. If you can see something like this on a big screen, go. I know that I believe Aaron Paul was, like, in L.A. handing out tickets to screenings at, I believe, their Alamo Draft House or
what,
something.
Just, like, on
there.
The street? And he was just passing them out?
Yeah, well, yeah, he tweeted the other day. He was like, hey, this bridge, I'm here for the next 5 minutes. If you want tickets, come say hi.
Come to the bridge.
And like, apparently people showed up, and, of course, they went to the screening. But, you know, I actually met Paul at a screening of another movie of his years ago out in California, and he's such a delightful human being that I want him to work in everything just because he's a good guy. And at the same time, he's a top-tier actor. I mean, everything he did, audiences really have come to know him through Breaking Bad. So seeing him one more time in the shoes of Jesse Pinkman, I think, is worth everybody's time. But also, he's one of the few actors who, when he cries, man, if you're watching it, you're not feeling it, I have questions for you. Mm. Like, he's just so good. And he's got the, it's like he's got the level of, the caliber of acting of like the best theater actors, you know, people that do it live where audiences are in the room and they really feel it, but he's able to do it on camera and on cue. And it's just, it's a talent and a gift. And he knows exactly what he's doing, and he's very deliberate in all of his performance work. And I just, you know, there's, go look at his filmography outside of Breaking Bad, and there's stuff that he's in that sometimes the movies aren't that awesome, but he's consistently good. Just 110% the whole way. So I can't say enough good things about the actor who inhabited this role, and we, I think, are going to enjoy seeing him step back into those shoes one last time.
So they couldn't have picked a more perfect weekend in the Chicago area to sit on the couch for many hours, because we got dropped about 30 degrees in 30 minutes. That's a great option for you to do. Anything else, you know, that you've got kind of percolating maybe that is out that people haven't, maybe not as many people have seen, or anything really quickly on the Netflix or the Hulus or the Primes, I don't know, you know what I'm saying. Good couch watching stuff that you got that maybe people is under people's radar a little bit.
If you are behind or have only seen trailers for the show Succession on HBO, I highly recommend checking that out. It is hilariously funny, for sometimes all the wrong reasons, but at the same time, great acting. I think the writing is engaging. I think it's fun to watch every Sunday night. I actually just picked it up about two and a half weeks ago, and I plowed through the first season because it's available to watch. And then the second season's finale, I believe, is this Sunday night. So you got time. It's like 10 episodes a season. It's kind of like HBO is just, you know, keeping these seasons concise. They're about 1 hour per episode, but you know, come for the rich lifestyle and stay for the amazing performances by Brian Cox, Jeremy Strong, and the rest of this cast. Because honestly, I've laughed harder at this show than I have a lot of things lately, and I think that it's picking up. Like, it's got a serious fan base out there, but I think it's one of those things where, you know, post Game of Thrones, you were hearing how people were like canceling their HBO subscription. There's nothing for me here anymore. Well, that's not true at all. There's a lot of great content. And if you want something that's on the newer side, it'll be wrapping up its second season here, I believe, this week. But Succession is something I'd highly recommend.
Blockbuster Blake Stubbs, based out of Peoria, Illinois. Dude, my last question, when are you coming to a Blackhawks game?
Oh, I'll be up there very soon.
Yes.
Very soon indeed.
Yeah, they play tomorrow night against Winnipeg. Puck drops at 6. More details coming up at the midnight news on that. Blockbuster Blake, as always, thanks so much for stopping by and chatting with us, okay?
Absolute pleasure. You guys have a great night.
And when am I going to see you again? You got to come up to a Hawks game, or I'll come down. I'll see you next month down in Urbana. I'm sure we'll go to our old watering hole.
I'm going to send you the old texty text, and we're going to set something up. And by the way, if listening audience wants to come too, I mean, they're more than welcome.
Yeah.
It is what it is. Yeah, we'll just have a lot of fun.
All right, Blake, thanks for chatting.
Thank you, guys. Have a good one.
After the break, we're going to play a little yay or nay, finish some headlines as well, and then what's up with space at midnight, and then we're going to find out what we learned today. All coming up on WGN. I'm tired of waking up on the floor. What the heck is this, Mike Heidemann? Oh, thank you, please. What are you leading in with?
I knew the title of the game, and we're gonna
play yay or nay, and
I forgot about the lyrics to the song. It happens sometimes.
What is it?
Isn't it the Beatles?
This is Ringo Starr.
Yeah, Ringo. Pop this up a little more. Let's hear it a little more. She said it was the finest in the land. What the heck? And I said no, I don't
no more. So, it actually has a positive message of not doing drugs, I suppose, but it was supposed to fit with the song, and we're supposed to dive into it, and then Ringo, it just happens sometimes with these songs. Great song, though.
I think the segment should just be playing this song for the next 3 minutes. No, I don't smoke it no more.
Oh, yeah, Ringo Starr, you know, a very unloved solo project.
Yeah, I could see why.
One of the B-side tracks,
about where it should be. Our respect for Ringo as a soloist is right where...
Your new anti-drug spokesperson.
Yes.
Ringo Starr.
Yeah, right? No disrespect, of course.
No, none whatsoever.
I know Roger's a big Beatles fan, so... Hey, you want to play a little yay or nay?
Yay!
Woo!
Okay, so here's how this works. It's really simple. And you can also join on in, too, 312-981-7200. There's no right or wrong answer. But the one caveat I'm going to make to this game is that if two people pick yay, the other person has to pick nay and make a coherent argument for it. So you don't want to get left behind. No. So we're going to read a couple of local stories, and I'll ask a question, yay or nay, and you got to explain afterwards. You guys cool with that?
Yeah, sure.
Sounds good.
All right, so we're going to first start off right here in Chicago, of course. City's first shared streets. This story comes from our good friends at Block Club Chicago. They're welcoming cars, bikes, and pedestrians in Uptown, and they could become permanent. So, you guys know when you're driving around and you've got separated bike lanes, you've got the streets, and you've got places for buses. Well, these are called shared roadways, where everyone kind of just goes and figures it out. So the alderman's going to ask the city council's pedestrian traffic safety committee to declare the pilot program that they've already been doing in Uptown some success. It was confusing for some people, but they say it has worked out. It was 2 years ago that they did this, and I guess there haven't been any issues. So it's a little brown sign. It says, slow down, shared street ahead. So, should we just share our streets? Should we stop drawing lines out there? Or should everyone just expect that everyone's going to be out there together sharing the roadways? Yay or nay? Roger.
Nay. Should we have shared streets?
Yeah, more nay. Nay. Why?
I like the lines. I don't trust drivers. I trust the bicyclists.
Mm-hmm. But you want those drivers to have those lines.
You can't have an excuse if you don't see the line.
Right, okay.
You know what I'm saying?
That's one nay. Michael?
I'm going to say yay, ooh, in fact, for that. Because I feel one of my favorite cities in the world is Amsterdam. They seem to do it correctly. Chicago's built in the same fashion as far as our smaller neighborhoods. Maybe it wouldn't work downtown as much as it would work in Uptown and Lincoln Park.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that we could all come together as a cohesive unit if we just try to make it possible, because eventually we're all going to have to go electric cars and bikes, because that's the position we're being pushed in. So, hey, might as well embrace it before we get left behind.
Yeah, I'm going I'm going nay with Roger. I'm going against the hippie Michael Heidemann about all this
living
really peacefully.
Kumbaya and all that crap.
No.
Me and Ringo are going to be in the other room over here, and we're going to just be living peace and love over it.
You, Ringo, stop doing whatever you're doing. All right, next story, yay or nay. So, Chicago Magazine published a story. There's been pushes. Of course, Lake Michigan's water levels are rising. They're slamming up on Lakeshore Drive, flooding the lanes. And people are starting to say, do we even need Lakeshore Drive? So, yay or nay, should we get rid of the drive? Michael Heidemann, you go first this time.
I'm going to say nay. We should not get rid of the drive.
Okay.
It not only is one of the greatest pieces of driving, as opposed to the traffic always is garbage, but the view of the city and the lake is beautiful. It's almost like our Pacific Coast Highway.
All right.
And you were able to build a great running path alongside of it. I'm sure you could do that without Lakeshore Drive, but I think that Chicago just wouldn't be the same.
All right.
LSD.
That's a nay. Hey, Ringo told you not to.
I'm sorry. Yeah,
right. Roger, right? Yay or nay, get rid of the drive.
Nay. Oh. It is a beautiful example of how to properly use land and lake and bring everything together, but with a caveat.
Okay.
There's a couple of
the game
places
is literally called yay or nay, and Rogers
nay with a caveat. Fix a couple of issues downtown and you're fine.
Okay. Yeah, the light at Chicago Avenue needs to go. All right, well, I am really screwed by my own rules here. I have to go yay now. I have to make the argument. I think it's nay as well, but yay. Yes, get rid of Lakeshore Drive, because we're all going to live in a yellow submarine like Ringo and Mike Heidemann, and we're going to be walking or flying everywhere. And at the end, look, we got 30 years left of Earth anyways, so let's get rid of the drive. Let's walk everywhere. God, I can't even make that stupid argument.
Wow.
That's the worst. Hey, the Tribune did a really cool story with Stacey Fitzgerald, who is the wife of Northwestern Go Cats. Pat Fitzgerald's the coach, obviously, his wife. Their three sons play football, and of course, the game is a little under siege. So, Roger, I know you have kids and grandkids. Michael and I don't. But would you let, in this climate, let your kids play contact football? Yay or nay, Roger Badish?
I'm going to have to go nay. Flag football is fine.
Okay. You want to avoid the contact.
Yeah.
Michael, yay or nay?
Sorry, I'm just testing it out.
What?
Okay, so
I'm going to say yay for the football. Yes, I played football when I was young. It's a great way to...
No, you're not a good advocate for it. You just slip that buzzer 10 seconds before you're supposed to. So you say, yeah, you played?
I played, and I it was a way to make friends. You learn different aspects of life as opposed to just playing sports and getting hit. When you get hit, you learn to pick yourself back up. There's a lot of weird character traits that come with a game of football. So I'm going to say, yes, I would love my kids
play. Can't you do it with another sport, though?
Nope. Just football.
That's it. That's the only
get rid
team.
Of all the other sports.
Well, never mind. Else. You convinced me. That's right. I am going to go, nay, I would never. I don't have kids, and maybe that would change later, but I don't think I'd let them in this climate. Both my brothers played college. Thanks, Mike. Played college football. My younger brother said he had dozens of concussions. And he has some issues. I mean, not anything severe, but he says his memory is bad, and he's only like 30, so he's set up for a great life when he's like 50. But he's already.
I think we can replace it with competitive lightsaber.
You and Ringo do whatever the heck you guys want to do.
Competitive lightsaber too.
All right, here's a good one. We got a new study out. This one will go through a little bit quicker, saying more and more Americans are eating when they're driving. The most dangerous things to eat when you drive are burgers, coffee and donuts, french fries, and candy bars. So, eating while you're driving, yay or nay? Roger Badish.
Yay.
Yeah, don't sound too
guilty,
excited.
Guilty.
But yeah, that's so you eat when you drive? No problems there?
Yeah, I've got no problems.
What's your favorite meal to engorge on in the car?
Oh, probably, because it's the only time I think I do it, probably from something from Starbucks with my espresso. Wait, properly covered so there's no spillage.
Oh, that's a drink. I see what you're saying. You drink an espresso. That's not bad.
Well, no, but I'm usually like I've got like a
are
one
you
of their
dunking a donut
with,
inside of it
well,
too?
No, I'm not dunking anything. I'm maybe a lemon cake, one of those little lemon slice of lemon cake.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the bag is there and you gotta concentrate on the road.
Roger's got a whole lemon cake, he's got a knife, he's trying to.
Yeah, I feel like you have silverware involved, a napkin
no
that you put in your like shirt and stuff, a bib.
So Brandon Pope, who was a co-hosting today on the Jam, we were talking about this story.
Yeah.
He will sometimes eat Olive Garden while driving in the car.
What?
Like spaghetti. Like
spaghetti pasta and a salad and some garlic bread.
Dip breadsticks and marinara. Yes.
Does I'm he like, tuck a napkin in his shirt?
I was blown
driving?
Away. I'm like, those endless breadsticks. You got a bunch of them in the glove compartment. Just stacks them in there for later. The soup's coming out of the couple.
Oh, no. Now there's soup. Oh, my gosh.
Michael Heidemann, yay or nay, eating in the car.
Okay, I'm going to go with this. Roger said yay. I'm going to say nay.
Okay.
No eating in the car.
You never do it?
Well, I drive a scooter, so it'd be a little bit hard to eat my soup.
Both hands on the handlebars.
Yeah, just scooting on down, getting some breadsticks stuffed in there.
But I might say the one caveat is the fact that there's nothing better than having a like McDonald's next to you and grabbing those bag fries
on
the bottom. Oof.
Oh, bag fries are the best.
They are. That's like one piece of heaven that you can enjoy.
I am going yay. I think I bought my Mazda because the front little, you get the cup holders, right?
Yeah.
And then there's like a place where you can throw some stuff. There's this little random square box where you can perfectly put a small McDonald's French fry.
Ooh,
it fits right there, and then the fries pop on up. So it's safe. It's right by where I'm shifting gears. So throw it in reverse. That's a fry. Throw it into drive. Two more.
There you go.
And park, and before I get in the house and have to face Enrique, just shove the rest in my mouth hole. But at least I'm parked at that point. So, yes, I'd say the French fries is okay to eat and drive. So that's your fun example of yay and nay.
Yeah.
Yay!
Yeah. That was great.
Yay and nay.
Jeez, that's a hot applause. Well, that crowd's real riled up back there. All those people you got back at the producer's booth.
You mentioned bag fries, and the people went nuts. All of Chicago.
That wasn't even was that the large crowd applause button, or was that just, no.
It was a small fry crowd
applause. Yeah, exactly. Whoa!
Oh, there's the large fry.
That's a stadium. Jeez. They filled up the United Center. They're simulcasting us inside, and 20,000 fans listening to this show.
On that new scoreboard.
Oh, yeah, I'm they're playing you. Us over there.
Yeah.
Boy, I can't think of a worse thing to broadcast on such a nice piece of equipment. But
Roger, do you really eat soup in your car?
No, I don't eat soup in my car.
You posted about the matzo balls earlier in the week, so I didn't know.
No, those. Trust me, matzo ball soup is not to be eaten anywhere that is moving.
Right. Exactly.
You don't want to spill your matzo balls.
We don't need to know what happened to you this week with your movements. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Then the news, 720 WGN.
Now it's time for Mike Wall from Space.com with What's Up with Space.
720 WGN. John Hansen here for the next hour. You heard the introduction. We haven't heard from him for a couple weeks, but we're so excited to have Mike Wall from Space.com on the line. Mike, how you doing?
Good, John. How are you doing, man?
I can hear the disappointment in your voice that Mike Heidemann, our producer, didn't add anything special this week for your introduction. It was the same as the last time. I'm sorry.
Well, no. I mean, once you reach perfection, I mean, it's best to kind of leave it alone. You don't want to mess with it.
Thank you, Mike.
Very good. Very good. All right. Hey, I wanted to start with a story you wrote a couple days ago. You got some great stuff in the last couple days, but I saw this one come across the wire, and I just was kind of blown away at how this happens. So remember when we talked about Pluto, and we decided that was like a dwarf planet instead of a planet? There's all this debate raging back and forth. You know, that kind of like makes sense to me. How do we discover 20 moons going around Saturn that we didn't know about before?
Yeah, it is pretty surprising, right, that there can be that many moons of Saturn in the first place. Now, this brings it up to, like, now Saturn has actually 82 moons. And, I mean, how these ones kind of evaded detection for so long is that they're really small. They're each only, like, a couple miles wide. And they actually had to use, like, a pretty big telescope down in Hawaii to stare at Saturn for a really long time. Time on these big telescopes is really precious, so it's hard to get that amount of time just to use for one thing like that. And so that might explain why it took so long to find these things. But yeah, it's just crazy. Saturn has 82 known moons now, and there's probably a few more in there that are even smaller than that or even harder to see. It's just crazy.
I'm trying to put myself in the mind of, like, the researchers, because, like, if I was the guy, I'm like, oh, there's one new moon. I want to broadcast this to the high heavens. And they're like, wait a second. There might be a few more. And then you're like, well, we got to 20. We might as well make an announcement here.
Yeah. 20 is probably a good threshold for announcement of new moons.
Yeah. Let's talk about some of the more recent stuff you've been talking about. And I'm kind of blown away at how quickly some of this stuff is happening. SpaceX launching NASA astronauts potentially into space into early 2020. Now, 2020 sounds like it's a long way away, but boy, we're just a couple of months away from that.
Yeah. This will be a big deal when it happens, you know. I mean, ever since the space shuttle retired back in 2011, I mean, it's been a long time since we've been able to put astronauts up into orbit. And, yeah, I mean, NASA, has been launching their astronauts on Russian Soyuz spacecraft ever since then. But now we're getting to the point where actually SpaceX is getting pretty close to doing it. They have, like, a $2.5 billion contract with NASA to start flying astronauts up to and from the space station. And they're getting there. Like, there was a big press conference, like, a couple days ago down at SpaceX. NASA's administrator, Jim Bridenstine, was there and touring the complex and just to kind of, like a good photo opportunity and so on. But both of them said that if everything continues to go well, then that first kind of crewed SpaceX flight to the space station could happen in, like, I mean, January, February, or March of 2020, which is not far away at all. You know, we're already halfway through October pretty much, so that'll be a big deal when it happens.
How's that going to work logistically? Because, look, obviously when we did Apollo and some of the other missions, you contract out parts of the spacecraft to private businesses. But at the end of the day, it's the folks at NASA who are kind of running the launch responsible at the end of the day. It's your own taxpayer dollars going towards, you know, the life and death of these astronauts ultimately. Yeah. How does it work in terms of, like, I mean, is it completely up to SpaceX and they're just paying for the flight on up?
Well, that's sort of what like NASA wants to have happen. I mean, they eventually want to hand over this sort of stuff almost entirely to the private sector, just because it's time consuming. You know, they don't want to get trapped in low Earth orbit like we kind of have been for the past 20 years or so. They don't want to have to devote all of their kind of human spaceflight money and time to just going up and down to the space station. You know, they're doing this like really publicized moon push and then onto Mars. That's what they want to be working more on. But yeah, it's like it's tough, like, to put your faith in a private company like this. It's pretty unprecedented. And so there, yeah, I mean, NASA is like working really closely with SpaceX on all aspects of their system, you know, of their capsule and their rocket, making sure that both are safe to fly astronauts. You know, it's been a really intensive process along the way. And having to kind of certify both of these things for human flight, go through all the safety checks, that's taken a long time. It's part of the reason why they haven't done it yet, just because it's such an exacting process because the stakes are so high, you know.
I may be overthinking it because, like you said, we've been using other nations to send our astronauts up already, so it's not an entirely foreign concept. It just does feel to me like, boy, if anything goes, God forbid, if anything goes wrong, it just seems so strange that it's, you know, it's not taxpayer funded flight that is then taking these people, these scientists up to the lower Earth orbit. Am I overthinking this?
No. I mean, it is a really different kind of paradigm. It's a big shift in how NASA is trying to do things. And yeah, and for them to put their trust, to put their astronauts' lives hands into put their astronauts' lives into the hands of these private companies is new. You know, I mean, private companies have always worked closely with NASA as contractors. You know, I mean, NASA's always kind of given contracts to Boeing and other companies to build hardware for them, but NASA has always been the ones, you know, pulling the final strings and leading the operations and all that. So this is something new. I mean, you're not wrong to be kind of weirded out by it.
Yeah.
Kind of like what's going to happen if something goes wrong? And that's a big question for all aspects of the new kind of space world that we're living in, you know, with private space flight taking off, and, you know, Virgin Galactic wants to start flying space tourists up and down to suborbital space pretty soon. There's some other companies that want to do that too. And that's a big question is like, what will happen if and when something goes wrong? You know, it could be one of those things that kills that entire space tourism business before it even really gets off the ground if you have a crash right away.
Boy, so, you know,
yeah, I mean, it's a really big deal.
You know, there's lawyers out there that are like salivating at being the first ones to represent and get into this space law aspect.
Oh yeah. And I'm sure that whoever flies on those first few flights of those private suborbital vehicles, the space tourists, they're going to have to sign a pretty lengthy waiver. There's going to be a lot of small print that they're going to have to put their signature below, probably.
If I have to sign one to go ice skating, then yes, I would imagine it would be a little lengthier than that.
Yeah.
All right, so 10 years ago, NASA slammed a hunk of space junk into the moon. They did it on purpose. Walk us through what happened 10 years ago.
Yeah, this is pretty cool. I mean, people have always kind of, I mean, we've like never really known all that much about the moon, even though it's been our neighbor since, I mean, almost the entire Earth was born. And like about 10 years ago, we started getting some inklings that maybe there was actually water on the moon in decent quantities. You know, like there are a few space probes got some measurements from from like lunar orbit that there seemed to be water kind of widespread on the moon. And so NASA about 10 years ago launched this probe called LCROSS, and like the plan was to just launch this thing toward the moon and to use the kind of second stage of the rocket that launched it as like a just like as an impactor and to aim it at a crater near the moon's south pole and just basically slam this like spent rocket body into this crater and blast up a bunch of stuff from the floor of the crater and then have this other spacecraft that launched on this mission to fly through that plume of debris that got blasted out and just see what was in there and then it would slam into the moon. So it was really fast. It had to do all of that measurement like 5 minutes before it slammed into the moon too. And that's what they did. And it was a huge success. I mean, they like hit this crater and blasted out a ton of stuff. And we ended up learning that about 5% of the crater floor of that crater near the moon's south floor was water ice.
Oh wow.
And so it's like, yeah, so if you take that and you extrapolate it to all the other craters that are at the moon's poles, you know, that's a ton of water ice. And this was a mission that really kind of got the world excited and thinking about, well, if there's that much water ice at the moon's poles, you know, it's not crazy to think that we could get there and set up a base there and use that water ice to keep our astronauts alive and to make propellant for rockets that land on the moon and then take off again and come back to Earth or go other places. So this was a big deal. And it sounds like one of those things that like a mad scientist would dream up. It's like, let's just slam a rocket into the moon and see what happens. But it actually worked pretty well.
We're going to take a quick commercial break. Mike, after the break, I want to ask you a story about you wrote about a couple weeks ago that I still cannot wrap my head around about three monster black holes about to collide. You're going to have to stick around and break this one down, okay?
Okay, sure thing.
Yeah, we'll do that after the break here on 720 WGN.
That's one small step for man, one giant leap for...
Mike Wall.
Look back up at the sky, because we're back with What's Up with Space.
Wow, you're quick, man. You're
he
quick.
Is quick at that one with some smooth jazz on the back end. Did you literally just replace Neil Armstrong's words with Mike Wall? One small step for man. What was it? Yeah,
that was, I don't know. I found that clip online. I guess it must have just been there from a different spacewalk or something. Really weird.
Yeah, that other one that people don't know about. All right, Mike Wall, we're talking about What's Up with Space, and this story caught my eye a couple weeks ago, and I'll read your... anytime you add an exclamation point in your headline, you know it's serious. Rare discovery, you say. Do you do your own headlines, or do you have editors that do those for you?
I mean, yeah, like I usually will suggest a few.
Right, yours are good.
It's not up to me.
Okay. Well, whoever did this one was great. Rare discovery. Three monster black holes are about to collide. You're going to have to help me with this one. Let's start from the beginning. What's a black hole?
Well, it's probably the like weirdest thing in nature. People know have heard of them, obviously, yeah. But they're really weird. I mean, our brains can't really comprehend what they actually are. They're basically...
That's not a good start for me. If you are having trouble comprehending it, then I don't know. Well, keep trying.
Well, it's a distortion of space and time. It's a point where there's so much gravity, basically, that time and space are warped so much that like the laws of physics break down at the center of a black hole. But the sort of traditional kind of definition is, you know, it's just a huge mass of like gravity that's so strong that like nothing can escape it, not even light. Mm. So it appears. It's usually like a collapsed star that was big enough when it died, its mass like all collapsed down into like to a singularity is what that point at the center is called, where the laws of physics as we know them break down.
So when we look into outer space and look, is it a void of light that we see, and that's how we're able to determine that's probably what's there?
Yeah, and we can see them too, because when they're actively feeding, sort of when there's material falling into them, which there often is, they generate lots of radiation that's not coming from the inside of the black hole, because we wouldn't be able to see it; it can't escape. But as this gas and dust is swirling around it, it's being accelerated to such incredible speeds that it's throwing off all this radiation, and like sometimes there are these like powerful jets of radiation that are just shooting off because this material is moving so fast as it's going into the black hole. And so we can see them from these jets that they blast out.
And when you say actively feeding, is there a point where it stops? And what happens then? Does the gravity just become too much that it explodes on itself? I don't know what, or do they just keep on growing?
No, it's just a question of how much material there is around it. If there's stuff around it for it to eat, it'll gobble it up. If it's close enough to get sucked in, then it'll gobble it up, and you'll like see these jets of powerful radiation coming off. But if it's already gobbled everything up in its neighborhood, you know, then it's kind of quiet, and you don't like see that stuff. You just see this big hole in space, it looks like, because it's just darkness.
So weird.
Yeah.
Okay. So three of them coming together doesn't sound good, or just is it just a crazy phenomenon?
It's pretty dramatic. It's not something people have seen before. So there's this, off in deep, deep space, there's this galaxy merger. Galaxy mergers are pretty common. You know, it like happens a lot. Even though space is big, galaxies are moving, and they have such high gravity that they get drawn toward each other and they merge. You know, like our own galaxy has grown over the years by kind of gobbling up smaller ones. And we're actually heading toward a big crash with another spiral galaxy, which is bigger than us, actually, like the Andromeda galaxy. We're gonna hit it in a few billion years.
Okay, Phil, you had me worried for a moment.
but like when these galaxies merge, every galaxy at its heart has a supermassive black hole, and just like giant, huge holes that can have like billions of times the like mass of our sun. And so when the galaxies merge, I mean, scientists think that eventually their supermassive black holes merge too. And we've sort of seen this happening, or we've seen evidence of this happening in sort of like one-to-one galaxy mergers, and their two central kind of supermassive black holes merge. But this study was about, well, there are three galaxies merging, and it looks like there are three central black holes, which are all gigantic, are merging too. And it, we're like seeing that happen. And it's just crazy and bizarre, and we're like seeing them kind of spiral toward each other, and eventually they're all going to probably coalesce. And it's going to be, yeah, it's just really, really crazy.
Yeah, and you say three monster black holes are about to collide. I know that the timeline in space is a little bit different than the timeline here on Earth in terms of what we, you know, what about to means. So do we have any idea what we know by about to collide?
Yeah, people should, I mean, yeah, it's not like it's going to happen over the weekend or anything.
I mean, right. I'm like, did I already miss it? I know this article posted a couple weeks ago.
No, it's just one of those things that's like happening. Yeah, I mean, geological time, cosmological time, it's all relative. It's probably going to happen over the next few thousand years or something like that. But what's exciting is that like when these things do happen, I don't know if people are kind of science oriented or space fans. You've probably heard about, think about gravitational waves and how we've recently actually detected gravitational waves for the first time. And those are like the ripples in space-time that get thrown off by when supermassive objects like are kind of moving fast. You know, I mean, Albert Einstein first predicted gravitational waves like 100 years ago, and they were finally first detected just a few years ago by a merger of two black holes. That's what kind of threw off these gravitational waves. So when these three supermassive monster black holes spiral toward each other and collide, they're gonna produce some pretty intense gravitational waves. And if we have the right equipment running at the time, we might be able to actually measure those and like learn a lot about these extreme environments and what goes on in these galaxy mergers. So it's just one of those crazy stories that you have to kind of like let your mind kind of drift a little bit to try to take in, but it's pretty cool.
So to recap, three monster holes about to collide, aka clickbait. Got it. Thanks. No, I'm just kidding, Mike. You gotta get people to click it. It's a fascinating story. We actually had a couple of texters that are like, boy, we are putting on our thinking caps tonight, and it's very enjoyable. Mike Wall from space.com, you guys do great work over there. Thank you so much for joining us again, and always giving up some time for us on a Friday night.
No worries. I was happy to do it.
Yeah, and I know Heidemann's already working on your next intro, okay?
I would expect nothing less.
Yeah, each week we got to keep on growing that thing. Eventually, it's going to be so long that we never even get to the interview. We'll just say, how was that? Good? Cool. All right, see you next time. All right, Mike, thanks a lot. We really appreciate it.
Sure thing. Talk to you later.
Oh, I love finding out what's up with space. I also love finding out what we learned today. That's coming up on WGN. Hey, amen to that, Roger Badish. By the way, Hugh Jackman, right? He played at United Center tonight, right?
Oh, is that? Let me double check.
Yeah, I think so. My question is am I confused?
What?
Hugh Jackman's an actor, right?
Yeah, he's also a very good singer.
Really?
Oh, you didn't know this?
Does everyone in the world know that but me?
Yes.
Okay.
I've seen his performance in Oklahoma.
And he was in The Greatest Showman.
Yeah,
which,
that's right.
But he's even better in Oklahoma.
But
go
is he
on
part
to...
of an act? Like, he was known for acting first, right? Or was he...
He's got experience. I think he's always had the singing talent.
Yeah, I get the talent. But, like, first came the acting notoriety.
Yeah,
and then now he's using that to advance his musical career.
Yes.
He wasn't, like, a former musician from some band that I don't know about.
No. Okay. It was always the acting. There's the performance... that I watched of Oklahoma is from England. Recorded. I forgot.
I think you're just throwing names out from the map. Wait, what? You went in Oklahoma?
No. I didn't go to England. It's recording of his performance in Oklahoma, which was staged
in
musical. London.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Staged in London.
Okay. Oh, there he is. I got a beautiful. Roger's just like, story over, I'm going to listen. This is awesome. Are you an Oklahoma fan, Raj?
I love it. One of the first musicals my mom ever took me to in downtown Chicago.
That's awesome.
Yeah. The other one was Sound of Music.
Oh, that's a classic, too.
Yeah.
Well, so I learned that Hugh Jackman is a singer, which is great news today. But guess what? I learned a bunch of other things today. Today, I learned. That's how we intro the segment. Just kind of spit out a bunch of words till the music came on. Even though the day is only 36 minutes old, it's sometimes nice to reflect back on those past three dozen minutes and realize, what have you learned today? You want me to go first, Mike?
Yeah.
Okay.
let's hear what you learned.
Yeah. Here's what I learned today. Today I learned that the final science exam for 8th grade students in Ketchikan, Alaska, is a two-night survival trip on an uninhabited island.
That's great.
Here's how the story starts from the Atlantic. "Oh my God, I feel like a murderer," exclaimed 13-year-old Bonnie Bright. "I've killed so many things on this trip." Sporting pigtails, glasses, and extra tufts, the brown neoprene boots, called the Alaskan sneaker, Bright didn't look like a serial killer. Yet in her hands was her latest victim, a chubby sea cucumber the color of burnt umber. Bright cleaved the slippery what kind of writing is it? Oh, the Atlantic. Oh, no, I got it. Anyways, point is, they go to this island, and they make these kids survive for 2 days, and that's how they pass the science class. How cool is that?
That's incredible.
All around her on a rocky gray beach, 19 of her classmates were performing similar drills. In total, the Coast Guard has dropped 103 middle school students, the majority of the eighth graders, on 6 different islands to survive for 2 days and nights in May. They have nothing. They don't give them anything except a 10-by-15-foot sheet of plastic. It's almost like Ron Swanson set this up, a sleeping bag. Clothing and whatever additional supplies they could fit into a coffee can. So they have to fit everything in a coffee can and do it. It's called the survival trip, known in the isolated island community. It's occurred annually for 45 years. It's the students' final science exam, but also more importantly, preparation for growing up in the unforgiving wilderness they call home. It's also just a survival test, or like just weeding out the youngins. I don't know what it is, but I hope everyone's made it back after making that joke. I'll have to look, but I imagine so.
If I had to do this, I'd take a 2-pound coffee can.
They tell you how big the coffee can is.
Oh, really? They do the size?
Yes.
It's not like bring his own from home.
Yeah, it's not like it's not like Slurpee Day where you can just bring whatever you want.
You know what? I would bring a 12-gallon drum of a coffee can.
You know what I'd do? A house of coffee, and I would put wheels on it, drive around, have the french fries in the front seat.
Well, you know, it's funny because it was very similar. When I went to school in Utah, we had an outdoors class for our college, and a lot of the students couldn't graduate until they went on an outdoor exposition, went hiking, made food.
Exposition or expedition?
What did I say?
Exposition. That would just be writing something about being outside.
Expedition.
Okay, yeah.
Expedition.
Mm-hmm.
Jeez.
I'm not sorry. I don't want to confuse the listener.
They're like, how much writing do you have to do in this coffee can?
So you had to do this.
You had to do this. So there are a lot of schools in the South, actually, and if you are around a lot of mountains, they make you go and take these outdoor classes because that's what they were brought up on. So it was interesting to see. I mean, that's next level.
That's Ringo Starr teaching that class.
That's like you're out there with Ringo Starr in a tent. Who knows what else he brought in that knapsack?
Yeah, what's in that coffee can? Grounds of something, I'll tell you that much.
Yeah, but that's cool that they do that.
That is cool. What would you put in your coffee can if you had to go on an island and try and survive?
Great question.
Yeah, what would you put? 312-981-7200. You got a little coffee can and a sheet of plastic, and you got to survive for 2 days. Well, I'd bring a gun. I'm just trying to think of, like, what's going to help me the most. Probably a gun. And you could probably fit some matches in there, right?
Yeah.
Never fired a gun.
It
would just be I would literally put a gun in there, matches, and just fill the rest of the space with bullets. And just, bam. If you're going to put me on an island, that's where I'm going to want a gun.
Find a
bear and just eat for months.
But that's the other thing. Like, what if you did find a bear and you got to take it down? How would you even get into the meat? Like, how would you even
figure that out? Get a lot of bullets. You really tear that thing
up. You got to skin that thing.
Well, I got bullets. I told you I have a coffee
can. That's not the way to skin it. You don't keep firing until the skin falls off and, oh, look, there's meat.
Don't tell me how to survive, Roger.
That you can't. Oh, I know. You can survive.
I wouldn't want to be in John's camp either.
Yeah.
The one guy with
let's not go back to the loons.
They're just like, well, John went into the forest. We heard about 70 rounds go off. He's eating good tonight. He's picking up shards of bear up in the trees. Michael, what are you putting in your coffee can? You already took this class. You should have a head start on this one.
Well, you definitely want to bring water. Water is very important. That's probably step one.
Wait a minute. It's an island. Yes, there's water
there's
all
fresh
over
water
the place.
Everywhere.
Oh, there's fresh water. Okay. Okay.
Well, that's a fair point. I guess we can't. What, Roger, what do you put in your coffee can?
Coffee.
Roger's like, I misunderstood the assignment. He just shows up with a can full of Folgers.
Hey, I got to stay awake or else I'm going to freeze when I sleep. I got to stay awake.
They're like, that kid, Maddish. He's going to end up dead because Hansen's going to shoot him 60 times.
We got to eat something.
We're going to eat a percolated Maddish. Okay, Michael, what'd you learn today? Oh, God.
You know,
people are saying really good answers, by the way. Swiss Army knife, that makes sense.
Swiss Army knife
and a Playboy magazine. Those are that's a good one.
See, we need to bring that person along because I think our trio right now, we wouldn't last a day.
We're in
afternoon.
Trouble. We got a bunch of guns, some coffee. It sounds like the recipe to immediate death. All right, Mike.
What Nutri-Grain bar.
What did you learn today?
So I learned that a lot of people have been taking over the Mount Everest march. You know, you see those lines and those social media photos where everyone does it. Well, one of the first people who ever climbed the mountain, Tenzing Norgay, was one of the first two men who reached the top of Mount Everest and didn't know when his exact birthday was. I mean, this was a long time ago. Actually, it wasn't that long ago. It was in 1953. But after his ascent on May 29th, 1953, he decided to celebrate his birthday the next day. And that was when he pinned down his birthday for such a great accomplishment that he did.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
So he was born in 1914 and just went, what, like 40, almost 40 years not knowing his own birthday?
Yeah, but there you go. He was able to pin it down because of that. That's cool stuff.
Yeah. Pretty incredible.
Just can't get the image of just a coffee thing full of bolt. Sorry.
Do you think, what would Norgay put in his coffee can? I don't think that he would be putting the same kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think he would choose different things than I have. Roger, you want to take the break first? You got something you learned today?
Well, quick thing here.
Yeah.
I love movies. I love movies, and one of my favorite movies, even though a lot of people don't think this is a good movie, but you remember the original Blues Brothers?
It's a great movie.
Filmed here in Chicago.
Mm-hmm. Do some people not think that's a good movie?
Well, I know a lot of people who don't like the original Blues Brothers.
Wow.
Who are
these people?
I know.
I got a coffee can full of bull.
See, now you just learned something new. You better load up that gun again there, buddy. You need a fresh supply of bullets.
I'm not advocating for that, but you should like Blues Brothers.
It was a pretty good movie.
It was pretty
a very good movie.
Aretha Franklin, right. Ray Charles.
I'm not going to choose this hill to die on, but I might choose it for you.
So, what was one thing that they used a lot of in that movie?
Cop cars.
You better believe it.
Is that okay?
Yeah. 60 old police cars that the movie bought.
Mm.
They bought them, fixed them up to make them look like real cop cars, and then destroyed the heck out of them.
I'm actually surprised it's lower than I thought.
Well, again, it looks like there were a lot of them until there was the big crash. There was two actual big crashes. So you've got the Chicago police cars crashed underneath the L downtown, remember?
Mm-hmm.
And then remember the state police cars. So those were old cars. Those were among the 60 when they're coming back from Indiana, and then all those cars crashed.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where all 60 of those cars went.
That's got to be expensive.
Very expensive.
But worth it.
Very worth it. Great movie.
Who doesn't like that movie? 312-981-7200.
I'm not going to say.
Yeah. All right, tell you what. We're going to take a quick commercial break. We'll find out what else we learned, and you can join the conversation. What have you learned today, 45 minutes into this Saturday morning on 720 WGN? 720 WGN, 1248 on this Saturday morning. Just 12 minutes away from Matt Bubala, who will take you till 5 a.m. I hope you're having fun. By the way, Roger, we do have a question from a listener. Yeah. Chef Roger, what are you going to make? Coffee rubbed bear steaks? I mean,
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Nothing goes better with a cup of espresso, I'm telling you.
Just some shards of bear that we found and just...
Well, I got to pull the bullets out first.
John must have been here.
Then I can roast that sucker up in a coffee saute.
Oh, the vegetarians are going to have a... Anyone, PETA has a big case against me right now.
I know that. Well, I wasn't the one who shot it.
No, I'm not blaming you. I don't advocate doing any of this, of course. I'm not a hunter. We did Roger What You Learned, right? Did
yeah.
We? Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. Let's find out what we learned today here. Oh, we learned a few things already. Boy, a lot about ourselves. That's really the point of this segment. Yeah,
of course.
We say it's to learn facts and random things, but really, it's the truth is we look inside.
Yeah, it's better to look inside than outside, unless, of course, you're driving.
19... yeah, you're right. Where's this off button? Okay. All right. So after a concert by The Who, this is what I learned. In 1976, this is in Anaheim at Angel Stadium. They had a concert in March of 1976. I don't know how true this is, but we'll go with it. Groundskeepers reported that after The Who concert, more than 100 marijuana plants sprouted on the baseball playing field in Anaheim. Mayor William J. Thom said the economic situation at the stadium has not reached such a perilous point that we have to resort to growing marijuana, but they'll never be able to play tee for two at Anaheim Stadium again. If you smoke, Mike, you'll be able to help us out with this.
Why'd you go to him first?
No reason. Or fine, I'll get in my time machine and go to Roger at SIU.
That's okay.
I really don't know. Like, if you are smoking weed, is the implication that if you're smoking weed at a Who concert, that some of the cannabis leaves would fall into the ground and grow? That can't be it, right?
No.
You'd have to, like, plant seeds in the ground to do this, right?
Plant seeds, put them in the right kind of conditions, heat lamps.
Yeah, I don't know how much I believe this, that 100 marijuana plants sprouted on a baseball playing field after a concert by The Who. Because I can't just imagine loose leaf cannabis in the form that you'd smoke it in a joint just falling to the ground.
There are, it's seeds that you plant, and there's buds that grow. It wouldn't be...
But would the seeds be in the smoking joint?
If you get really bad
yes. Yeah, maybe they're getting bad buds.
If you get a bad mixture, if uh-huh. I may, not from personal experience,
no,
but
may.
From knowing many...
That's what's really in his coffee can.
Now we figured it out.
Yeah, we got it.
2-pound can, more than enough. But there are some mixtures of marijuana that you might buy from someone or someplace mm-hmm. that does have seeds from the marijuana plant.
Okay.
That could, as you're making your marijuana cigarette, better known as a joint, that may fall from your fingertips as you're trying to roll the cigarette and could fall to the ground. And
so
then
it's plausible.
And it's plausible because then it falls into the dirt,
uh-huh.
and the rain comes in, sunshine, you have everything that makes for... What are we listening to?
I don't hear anything, Roger. What are you hearing?
What's going on, Roger?
Yeah, what are you,
I don't
what are you
know.
Off in the distance
Tell
there?
Me.
Right. The carpet here at WGN is all of a sudden playing.
Thank you.
No, I'm just kidding.
Well, there was a... I think there was a... God, no, I can't think of the... comedy
I wonder why not.
Yeah, right?
What's going on? Sort of
he's speaking slowly. He's spacing out, taking long breaks during his news breaks.
There was a...
he wasn't coughing. No, I'm just
No,
kidding.
I wasn't.
Oh, that's why you're coughing.
That was... Well, you know, took a little... No.
for the record, he
Why
didn't.
Can't I think of the comedy name now? The,
I don't know.
The two guys who
Cheech
made
and
a
Abbott
living.
And Costello?
No, no, oh, not that old, please.
Cheech and Chong?
Back, huh?
Cheech and Chong.
Cheech and Chong. There was a bit on one of the comedy albums where the song went, "No stems, no seeds that you don't need."
Okay.
Acapulco Gold is some bad seed or weed. So
there you go. So it's possible. Go.
It's possible.
Okay. Now I'm picturing Abbott and Costello smoking pot. They would have never. No wonder
so.
Why they couldn't figure out who was on first. Boy, that was really confusing. That wordplay, that clever wordplay, couldn't figure it out. Now we know why.
That's why they only performed it like once a month.
Yeah. And they still were confused every single
time.
Right. What the heck is happening? All right, so hey, do you have one more thing, Michael, that you learned?
I have
learned?
A quick one.
Yeah, go ahead.
Today I learned that Monday, we were talking about space with Mike Wall from space.com. Monday is named after the moon, Sunday is named after the sun, and Saturn is named after what, John? Or Roger? What do you think?
Saturday would be named after Saturn.
Saturn, yes. Yeah. So I had no idea that was the case.
I didn't either.
Yeah, each day of the week is named. You know what Thursday is named after?
Thor, so Jupiter?
You got it. Thor.
Yeah,
the thunder god.
What's Friday?
Those French fries you sit in your car next to you.
Friday, I think, is... Oh, man, I used to know this.
Some old planet.
No. It's named after Odin. No.
That's
Wednesday.
Wildly.
Wednesday is named after Odin. Woden's Day.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, apparently we didn't learn what Friday was named after.
Yeah, look it up.
All right. I think we have time for one more.
Friday. Oh,
I got one if you want it.
Oh, go ahead.
So
first of all, let Michael answer the question.
Go ahead.
Go ahead, Michael.
TYR, Tyre, was one of the sons of Odin, or Woden, the supreme deity after whom Wednesday was named after. But similarly, Friday is named and derived from Frigga, the wife of Odin, representing love and beauty.
There you go.
We do love it. All right, Roger, what else did you learn today?
So, Halloween's coming up, and I'll treat the candy treat that a lot of people don't like, circus peanuts.
Yeah, they're gross.
They're the
orange foamy ones.
Yes. So this is a coated peanut-shaped marshmallow candy.
Mm-hmm.
They date to the 19th century, and it is thought to have originated in Dover, Delaware, as the invention of a chemical engineer. After fashioning a foam peanut-shaped insulation for use in preventing drafts in his livestock barn, he was so pleased with the texture and the shape of the insulation, he was inspired to create it or recreate it as a confection.
Insulation inspired him for a candy?
Yep.
That makes a lot of sense, actually.
That lines up.
And he would sell small bags of the candy peanuts each year when the circus would pass through town.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I just pictured it was some guy who was drunk or high and started eating his styrofoam cooler. And he's like, you know what? Let's make this candy. Because that's the sensation I get from circus peanuts. Styrofoamy.
Yeah.
No, I hate it.
I like it. If you get a fresh bag.
But I don't hate Peeps, so I'm fine with those.
Okay.
And I like candy corn.
You're not the only one.
Yeah.
I love it, but in moderation.
Well, right. Everything in moderation. Yeah. No, I never had a problem with the candy corn. Do you like candy corn, Mike?
I do like candy corn. I've never heard two people in the same room who also like candy corn, though.
I know. How about this?
Aw.
Guys, big group hug here. There we go.
Squeeze
on in.
Good group hug.
All right, I learned one more thing today. Today I learned that common ravens have been observed calling wolves to the site of dead animals. The wolves open up the carcass, leaving scraps more accessible to the birds. So ravens are working with wolves so that they can get their food. I'm also learning how I'm going to eat this bear. I'm just going to get as many ravens. Fire off my gun as many times as I can. Hey, ravens, get over here. There's a bear that's dead here. Start cawing or doing whatever you got to do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then all of a sudden, here come the wolves.
Well,
I'll shoot a couple of them, too.
You're going to have a smorgasbord by the end of this retreat.
We're going to have shish kebabs of many different meats.
Ravens are the smartest bird by far. Every single time I learn a new fact about them, it astonishes me. They also, believe it or not, take nuts, like from trees and everything, and the way that they open them, because their beaks can't open them themselves, is they bring them to the highway and put them on the street for the cars to run over them, and then they eat what's inside.
I feel like you're making that
no,
up.
No, I'm dead serious.
Really?
They are very, very intelligent.
They're adjusting
animals
to human behavior. How mm-hmm. about that? Hey, Matt Bubala walked in the room. Matt, how are you doing today?
Hey, good, John Hansen. How are you, buddy?
Doing really well. We've had a fun show here, and I imagine you'll carry the ball and continue
I'm
it on.
I'm going to try, yes.
You're going to probably do a U-turn and make it, you
just
know,
really
good.
Just really sad. Oh, is that? Oh.
No, are you going? Are you?
Well, you said you've had a really fun show, and then he said, I'm going to make a U-turn.
No, not sad. I think you're going to bring legitimacy back to WGN Radio.
Well, let's not push it.
Yeah. What do you got coming up today?
Our buddy Troy Laravier, he ran for ran for mayor for a short time last year. He's the head of the Principals Association. He's going to come in, chat with us about where we are with this whole teacher strike that appears to be getting not closer to being resolved necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
That's supposed to happen this Thursday, so we'll chat with him about that.
Yeah, boy, that's a messy situation, too, with the CTU, CPS, and they're playing the game that, you know, traditionally gets played in the public, with Mayor Lightfoot, of course, kind of saying, hey, look, teachers, we're not getting quite the responses we want from you guys, but
yeah,
we don't always know what's happening in the bargaining room. And
well, I'm sure the teachers would say, no, this is not how it's happening,
exactly,
Mayor Lightfoot.
Exactly.
That's what you're saying. And she's in a tough position, you know, brand new mayor, got three different factions threatening to go on strike this Thursday.
Yeah.
Not just the teachers. So she's in a tough position as well. So we'll find out a little bit of the background on where we are in that. Later in the show, I know you guys talked about space stuff a little bit earlier. At 4 a.m., we have a guest on. He wrote a book about Fermi's paradox.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? Oh, look at that.
Nope. Nope. I just am nodding that
Fermi's paradox is.
No, I don't.
It's the question that Fermi posed to his colleagues over lunch one day, hundreds of years ago. Like, if there is intelligent life elsewhere, we know that there's billions of planets, billions of everything. Why have we not found it?
Hmm.
Is it really out there?
Right. I imagine because it's so big. I'll be looking forward to that. Have a great show, okay?
Thanks, bud.
All right, that'll wrap things up for me. You can catch me weekdays on The Jam, CW26, 6 to 8 a.m., or at all home Blackhawks games as your stadium MC. Come say hi in Section 312. Matt Bubala is next here on 720 after the news, WGN.